Welcome back. We are in part two of a conversation on racism. And just for those of you who weren't here last week, I want to offer a brief overview before jumping into what we will be discussing more extensively tonight. First of all, why? Why are we discussing this? Because racism is an anti-gospel. It is opposed to unity in society and in the church. It is poisonous to everyone and everything that it touches. We're discussing it tonight, not apart from recent events. Although racism has long been in the history of the world and in the history of our country, there's a particular poignancy in discussing it in our current context. Even in this last week, ABC canceled its top-rated network show because of inflammatory tweets by the show's creator with racial undertones. It is very much in the forefront of our national conversation and dialogue. And it's important because the church, despite the heroes that we have offered up in the fight against racism in the past, those who have fought for the abolition of slaves and for equity of all peoples, we have also, especially as an institutional white church, been wrong on racism again and again in the past. We have taught slavery. We have taught the curse of Ham. We have given theological justification for the toxicity of racism. And we're discussing it as a way of brief overview because we have a problem. We have a current problem in America that is not a new one, but it is rearing its head with a particular manifestation. We have a problem as we see the Charlottesville rally that resulted in the death of a counter-protester. We have a problem with white nationalists chanting and holding signs up against Jews and people of color. We have a problem with the names of people like Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, these most recent casualties in black bodies in the streets. Even this April, there was the story of a 14-year-old boy who had missed the bus to school in Rochester Hills, Michigan. He was walking to school, stopped to ask for directions at 8:20 in the morning. This young black boy knocked on the front door and began explaining what he was there for. And the woman started shouting, convinced that he was going to rob her. Her husband came out with a shotgun and chased him off their property with it. And this is just one story that made recent headlines. There was the shooting in Charleston, where a white supremacist gunned down 9 parishioners. There was even this last week, perhaps you did not get your coffee in Starbucks on Tuesday because all the Starbucks around the country, save a few, shut down for anti-racism and racial awareness training. We periodically have had protests that will continue with the Black Lives Matter movement. We also, by way of review, looked at American history, how issues of race shaped our founding story, with the myth of manifest destiny that allowed us to push off Native peoples onto reservations to re-educate them in schools. We discussed how this legacy bled into slavery, Jim Crow laws, redlining, rape, lynching, drug policies, and mass incarceration. And there were two poignant images that I hoped would illustrate some of what we were doing, and they bear repeating again tonight. The first had to do with a slave castle that I visited in Accra, Ghana. This is the hold where black Africans were kept before making the transatlantic voyage. And one of the things that was most striking to me was the grate, the only area that allowed in light and air, had to be passed over by all of the settlers who lived in that castle as they entered the Anglican church that was built right above it. The music actually and the bells from the church service could be heard within those holds. And it is a chastening and a question to us. Where are the ways when the church is either complicit or silent in areas of injustice that we are passing over the need of our brothers and sisters? This is the church. The other image was that of a foam roller And for any of you in the exercise world who are acquainted with foam rollers, you know that this is something that you just sit on. When you need release from pain, you lay on the foam roller and you wait. And it is really uncomfortable. And there's not a promised time horizon as to when that muscle is going to release. And yet you do it. And once you've experienced that release, you know it's worth it. It's worth doing. And so if there was any discomfort that was experienced either last week or this week, my hope in a spirit-filled way is that it's worth it. And it's moving us towards greater wholeness and greater healing. And I want to say again at the start, I am so happy to be an American citizen. I love America. America has been a force for great, great good in the world. I am the daughter and granddaughter of veterans. I love our national story. There is no other place that I would want to be a citizen of. And frankly, these founding ideals that we were based upon, that all men are created equal, is what motivates me in part even tonight, this promise that at first was only true for white men in America, but through successive generations is beginning to expand, is continuing to expand. I'm reminded of this line from a really great poem by Langston Hughes. He writes, who is a black poet, he writes, "America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." I feel like the ideals of America push us to this conversation, but I stand here and we gather here tonight as much more than Americans. Yes, it's part of our American identity, but much more so, we gather for this important conversation out of deep conviction of as people of the good news of one body, one uniting gospel. I also, as we jump in, want to note that last week I would have introduced a video that I showed a little bit differently. I showed a clip and people had some questions as to what it was from. These were comments that President Trump made at a rally before he was president. They were in reference to people of color that were protesting, and his phrasing was, in the good old days, these people would have been taken out on stretchers. And I want to say that in our current political context, this was not meant to be shown as a wholesale condemnation of anyone who supported President Trump. I believe that there are all kinds of reasons why people of good conscience could have voted and supported and continue to support him. And if you would like to have that discussion with me, I studied political science. I would enjoy it. We can get coffee at some point. But regardless of whether or not you voted for him and currently support him, I believe that we as people of faith all must roundly condemn the way that he speaks about minorities, women, and pretty much anyone that he disagrees with. It is against what we are called to, and he's influential. We are called, actually, scripture leads us to hold our leaders to account. He is influencing the national discourse powerfully in this way, and therefore, I think it is important. We need to discuss it in this church. It's not how Jesus would speak. It's not how we should speak, and it's not how we should be a part of the national conversation. And our faith, foundationally, is political always. As much as politics is that which influences the realm in which we live, our faith is always about shaping the public sphere. And I also want to offer these caveats. Tonight, there are things that I will miss. I am on my own journey in learning about these issues. I speak from my own position as a white woman. At this moment, as I miss things, I appreciate those of you who have offered feedback last week. I invite you again to do so this week. Also, although we have 2 Sundays to do this, there is no way that we will cover the many nuances and perspectives that shape this conversation. Tonight, also, we'll be focusing on the voice of Black Americans. That is not because this conversation doesn't affect many, many different other groups. But for the constraints of time, theirs is the voice that we will be focusing on tonight. And The voices that you hear represented in some of the videos or perspectives also can't be construed to speak for everyone of a given race or perspective. They're expressing their own perspective on a complicated issue. So, in the midst of people voicing their pain, there is a temptation, especially for white Americans, to disbelieve, to question, to maybe want to pull apart, and to frankly feel uncomfortable. And I would remind us, as we begin this conversation, of what the book of James tells us, that we are called to be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. We might not like the messages that other groups are giving to us, and we might, at the end of the day, not even think that they are the completeness of reality, and yet we are called to be shaped by their stories. And perhaps at this moment, you are feeling a little off balance, maybe after last week, a little uncomfortable. Perhaps you are maybe feeling like some of the people in this video.
It's very uncomfortable to talk about race. It's not something I do.
I am feeling apprehensive because I think there's a lot of reasons why I feel like I should be able to talk about race.
I don't want to say anything, that would offend anyone.
It's a very touchy subject. It's still difficult, even if you feel like you're on the right side of it, to have a dialogue about it.
Especially for white people, because we don't want to see if the racism that we may be holding on to.
I don't know. Maybe I am racist. I certainly don't like to think that I am. And I think that's too, because the perception in this society, the perception of a racist is a guy in a robe.
Now I understand that it's a system of advantages and disadvantages based on race. So as much as there's the disadvantage piece of it, there's the advantage piece of it, which is what I experience as a white person.
I want to bring up race, and I want to bring it up in a frame that helps my children think that there's no difference. But the mere fact that I might be bringing it up could suggest that there is a difference.
I remember asking a friend of my father's who's black, why he was called black, because his skin was brown. And I've learned that lots of people that are white ask this question, and maybe they also received the answer that I got from my parents, which was like, oh my gosh, we're so sorry that she asked that, and it's just a term, like, move on.
One of my third grade students seemed pretty rocked after the Eric Garner case or death, and came up to me and said, you know, why, when you were little, like, were you worried about this stuff too? And I knew what he was talking about before. I mean, I didn't say, what do you mean, what stuff? I didn't want to, you know, play dumb. And I said, you know, no, like, I didn't have to be, and that's not fair. And that was really hard, because he just kind of sat there, and it honestly seemed like the first time that he had considered the fact that not everyone had to think about race all the time.
I know that I'm white, and I guess I'm part of that collection. I don't think about being white. I don't.
I really did not know that I had a racial identity. I knew I was white. I had no idea what that meant, how that had shaped my outlook on life, how that had shaped my sense of optimism, sense of belonging, sense of safety, sense of feeling entitled to go help children that I thought were part of a community that couldn't figure out how to help themselves.
I think that impulse, that kind of colorblindness impulse, comes mostly from white people. Like, I've never heard, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it comes from all people of all kinds, but I've heard it most from white people who are saying, like, let's do this as a way of getting past this racism thing. And I think in part it comes from a sense of shame and guilt about what racism has done, and and kind of how racism was built by white people.
I don't want to be ashamed of being and plus I'm a male. It's like every group out there can be pissed off at me because I'm white and a male. And that's a weird kind of burden that some people do feel, and I certainly feel it sometimes from people that I'm privileged, I get stuff that other people don't get.
I think we're all implicated in a racist system, and I play my part in it as a white person. So I do have individual responsibility and accountability. I mean, I'm part of the system, and I do things that both perpetuate it, and I try to certainly do things that challenge it.
I realize I've never said anything. When I've heard racist jokes, when I've heard racist comments, I've never said anything. I've never spoken up and said, hey, that's racist. Not once.
In my mind, I'm not involved in any conflict that involves race. I've only been the beneficiary of it. So to talk about it is I don't think I would sound very wise.
Being white means that I have the privilege to think that I'm not affected by racism. Or that I don't even have a race, because I have all these other things, like a gender and a sexual orientation, and those are pretty neat, so I don't have a race. But I do, and I'm white.
So there's a term that came up in that video, talking about systems or structures of racism. And it's worth pausing over that term to define it. None other than John Piper offers this definition. Structural racism is the cumulative effect of racist feelings, beliefs, and practices that become embodied and expressed in the policies, rules, regulations, procedures, expectations, norms, assumptions, guidelines, plans, strategies, objectives, practices, values, standards, narratives, histories, records, and the like, which accordingly disadvantage the devalued race and privilege the valued race. Implicit in this definition is the important fact that structural racism, therefore, may have its racist effects even if non-racist people now inhabit the institutions where the racist structures hold sway. So this idea that there could be implicit racist structures that are still influencing outcomes regardless of the people that inhabit them. Do we believe that there's the possibility of systems that preference one group over another and that we might perhaps be the beneficiaries? And now, some of you are thinking right now, that is baloney. I have no concept or framework for that. And you might even look at history and you would say, I mean, aren't things so much better than they were? I mean, and they are. They're better than 60 years ago when black men and women were lynched, or even further back when they were enslaved, raped without impunity, when they didn't have to share bathrooms or bus seats. And haven't we passed laws? I mean, haven't we institutionally set some things into the structures of our nation to make sure this doesn't happen again? I mean, we've even had a biracial president. And the answer is yes. Yes, we are improving on racial issues. We are not where we were. Does this mean that all things are now just and equal? Let me draw an imperfect comparison. So things are better for women than they were 60 years ago, when the horizons of possibility were really limited to working within one's home or were very limited in the world of career. They are better than they were where at the turn of the 20th century women couldn't vote. And in America, they are much better than they are for women throughout the world, women who are under burqas, women who are not allowed to leave their homes or get an education. Yes, things are better. In fact, we now have women executives. We have much more of a voice in the public sphere. We do all kinds of things. We make movies. We play professional sports. Abuse is taken more seriously. And yet, would I say, would you say that all things are now equal? That every battle has been won? No. The Me Too movement this year has highlighted the voices of sexism that are still implicit in so many places of our world. The voices of women that are marginalized within the church and within broader society. The continued abuse that happens on the cutting edge of gender. There's still a need for advocates. There's still a need for equity. There's still a need for improvement. So too, for minorities in the United States, things are better, but outright racism and structural racism remain. Now, you might be beginning to think, okay, within my paradigm, this is possible, but really, since we haven't experienced the downsides of it, what are some examples of how structural racism looks? How does this really express itself? Perhaps this brief video will help. Oh, I actually want this one first. This video.
You've probably heard a lot about systemic discrimination in America. It's the idea that if you're not white, the deck is somehow stacked against you. And that is true. Government studies and academic research show over and over again that to be black in America is to face bias. What you might not realize is just how constant, varied, and idiosyncratic that bias can be. So, using all these studies, let's try to paint a picture of a life that millions of black Americans live. If you're black in America, you run into bias at a pretty young age. If you walk to school in the morning, you might have to wait longer to cross the street. Drivers stop less frequently for black pedestrians than for white. If you misbehave in school, you might be punished more harshly than your white classmates, even if you broke the same rule. And when you apply to colleges, your disciplinary record might make it harder to get in. If you're black in America and you're looking for a job, you might have to look harder. Job applicants with black-sounding names receive fewer callbacks than those with white-sounding names. And if you get the job, keep in mind that you'll be working just as hard as your white colleagues, but might make 30% less than them. If you're black in America and you want to buy a house, your agent might show you fewer properties than his white clients. And if you manage to find your dream home, you might have a harder time getting a bank loan. If you're black in America, you might get pulled over by the police more than your white friends. If that happens, police are more likely to search your car, and they're more likely to use force against you if there's a misunderstanding. If you're arrested and convicted of a crime, your sentence might be harsher too. If you're black in America and you get sick, you might have to tough it out. Doctors prescribe pain relievers to black patients less frequently than to white patients. And sometimes life-saving heart medication, too. If you're black in America and you're getting older, make sure to plan ahead. You might have a harder time getting into a nursing home than your white friends or family. And finally, if you're black in America and you're tired of this bias and you want to use your vote to change the system, it won't be easy. When you try to learn about where or how to vote, local officials might not even return your call. Now, there are some caveats. First, Hispanics, Asians, and other minorities face a lot of these situations, too. And second, this story is based on studies and surveys, so not all of these situations are true for every place in America at every time. But it does paint a pretty consistent picture. If you're white, it's a picture that might shock you. If you're not, you might have faced a lot of this already.
So that's some of the data in some surveys, and yet our minds or perspectives are never changed just by raw data. There's always a story that is behind the experiences of some of these injustices. Last week, we heard from some black boys talking about what it is to grow up black in America, and I want to have another piece of that story as their parents talk about facing one aspect of systemic racism having to do with interactions with the police.
My father's conversation with me was daily.
My grandfather talked to me as a black man from Augusta, Georgia, growing up in the Deep South.
It's probably Rob, my older brother, had this conversation. But then it's more of like, you know, wear a condom, do this. You know, it's like man, it's like little man lessons.
When a cop pulls you over.
When you get pulled over, not if you get pulled over.
At some point, you will get pulled over. And here is how you act.
As a young black man growing up in New York, I've had, you know, a few run-ins with the police and being completely innocent.
The people pull us out of the car, throw us on the floor. It's in February, so it's like snow and slush and stuff on the ground. Put their knees in our back, put the guns to our head.
As I'm putting my hands on the steering wheel so I don't make the police nervous, I realize how nervous I was. And then I realized my children were nervous.
The thing that people say is you have to talk to him before he experiences racism himself. But when is that?
He is going to turn into a large, scary black man. And that is, that's not who he is, but that's how he will be perceived. I know what this kid's going to look like. He's going to look like him. You know, I know what he's going to look like.
I'm a large, scary black man.
You are a large, scary black man, okay?
That's a problem in and of itself.
And that's a problem.
I am not large nor scary.
I can't do anything with that.
I'm short. Anyway, go ahead.
It's frightening, and I'm being very light when I use the word frightening.
If something goes wrong, your first line of defense, you know, the parents not being there, is to go to the police.
If you're Caucasian.
So, I mean,
yes,
still,
that's what you
still
teach your children. Unfortunately, you know, it can't work for black children, right?
It doesn't mean that every police officer is inherently a bad person. But what it does mean is that the police force, that institution, does not look out for your best interests.
There's this unspoken code of racism and white supremacy that says that my life does not matter.
You can put your hands up and say and cooperate and say that I'm choking and still be killed, and then there's no repercussions.
It's maddening. I get so frustrated and angry about having to prepare my kids for something that they're not responsible for.
And these are conversations that people of other races do not have to have with their children.
The conversation with him was really just, look, you're a beautiful young boy.
Being an African American is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful blessing. You have come from great people, but it's also a hard thing.
In America, because of your skin color, as a black boy and as a black man, we are going to be dealing with a lot of danger.
Under no circumstance are you to talk to the police if you're arrested until I get there.
Do what they say. Don't get into any arguments.
Make sure your hands are out of your pockets so they can see.
These are the questions you can ask. This is who to call. This is what happens if this bad thing. It's not like, please, master, don't whip me. No, it's like, excuse me, sir, what is your badge number? I'm going to film this.
If you want police brutality to stop, if you want police to treat you like a human being, then you have to see yourself as a human being.
You have every right in this world that anyone else does.
What I love about you as my son is I remember when we thought about having you and, you know, knowing that we wanted you and watching you grow.
You are the Muhammad Ali, you are the Malcolm X, you are the Martin Luther King.
You are an amazing young man, and the future is yours.
And I will do my best to make sure you're safe. That's it. I love you.
Are there structures that oppress? We're actually a people that believe that these structures exist. Ephesians 6 tells us, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. There are structures of religion and government that oppress. We see it in the Old Testament. We see it in the New Testament. We see it throughout human history. The structures of religion and government that were built and they left out the widow, the poor, the needy, the foreigner. This is why all throughout the Old Testament, the prophets, and throughout the New Testament, Jesus is always calling us to correct these structures that oppress, to not only correct how we personally relate, but to draw attention to, we do these things corporately. And it shouldn't be that surprising. As we look in Romans 1, the writer of Romans tells us that although we are children of God, made for unity with him, as we turn away, we have become filled, starting in verse 29, with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They're full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. This is what humanity looks like when we are far from God, when we are refusing to turn to him. And this is what we do even to people within our own groups, let alone to people that we define as the other and as different from us. How much more is this the way that unchecked and unredeemed we treat the outsider? Are we in or are we out? This is what people do throughout history, and it's not just an American problem, it's a human problem. You see it with the Samaritans in Scripture. You've seen it with the Irish. You see it in different countries. You see it in Kenya with the Luyos and the Kikuyos. You see it right now with the Rohingya Muslims in Burma. This is what people do. We create structures to privilege ourselves and to keep others out. Paul calls this the wall of hostility that Jesus had to come to knock down, for he himself is our peace, who has made the two one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility. Now, he was speaking about Jews and Gentiles, another group with a ton of different religious and cultural differences that had all kinds of problems interacting with each other in the New Testament. And yet, despite the fact that these structures are present throughout human history, despite the fact that we see it in Scripture, still, as white Americans, when you say that there is a structure that might benefit you, oh, there's a pushback. There's a little pushback in my spirit, maybe in yours as well. We don't like the language of systems of advantage. And why not? Well, it kind of feels like it robs us of our particular story. Do you know how hard I've worked to get where I am? Do you know all the burden and things I've had to overcome? We want to see ourselves as rugged individuals, the self-made man or woman in this story. I am, and it's just not true. I mean, I am who I am in a large part because of who my parents were and are. There are so many times still that I am able to traffic on the good name of my grandparents or my parents here in town. I know within my own story, I don't come from nothing. It's not true in any of our stories. Jim Wallace, in his book, America's Original Sin, quotes Robert Jensen, who writes about his own struggle in being able to see some of these systems. And Jensen writes this: "Like anyone, I have overcome certain hardships in my life. I have worked hard to get where I am, and I work hard to stay there. But to feel good about myself and my work, I do not have to believe that merit, as defined by white people in a white country, alone got me here. I can acknowledge that in addition to all the hard work, I got a significant boost from white privilege, which continues to protect me every day of my life from certain hardships. At one time in my life, I would not have been able to say that, because I needed to believe that my success in life was due solely to my individual talent and effort. I saw myself as the heroic American, the rugged individualist. I was so deeply seduced by culture's mythology that I couldn't see the fear that was binding me to those myths. Like all white Americans, I was living with the fear that maybe I didn't really deserve my success, that maybe luck and privilege had to do more with it than brains and hard work. I was afraid I wasn't heroic or rugged, that I wasn't special. I let go of some of that fear when I realized that indeed I wasn't special, but that I was still me. What I do well, I still can take pride in, even when I know that the rules under which I work in are stacked in my benefit. I believe that until we let go of the fiction that people have complete control over their fate, that we can will ourselves to be anything we choose, then we will live with that fear. Yes, we should all dream big and pursue our dreams and not let anyone or anything stop us. But we all are the product both of what we will ourselves to be and what the society in which we live lets us be. A first step for white people, I think, is to not be afraid to admit that we have benefited from white privilege. It doesn't mean that we are frauds who have no claim to our success. It means that we face a choice about what we do with our success. Sociologists call some aspects of this white privilege gene the invisible knapsack that we as white people get to carry. Some examples of things that are in your invisible knapsack were written by Peggy McIntosh, who's a sociologist. She has 26 written here. For the sake of time, I will read but a few. I can go shopping alone most of the time, pretty well assured that I will not be followed or harassed. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer letters without having people attribute these choices to the bad morals, the poverty, or the illiteracy of my race. I can arrange to protect my children most of the time from people who might not like them. I can turn on the television or open the front page of the paper and see people of my race widely represented. I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group. I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race. I can criticize our government and talk about how much I fear its policies and behaviors without being seen as a cultural outsider. I can be pretty sure that if I ask to talk to the person in charge, I will be facing a person of my race. I can take a job with an affirmative action employer without having coworkers on the job suspect that I got it because of my race. I can be sure that if I need legal or medical help, my race will not work against me. If my day, week, or year is going badly, I need not ask of each negative episode or situation whether it has racial undertones. Now, not all of these advantages are bad. In fact, some of them are positive ones that we would want to spread to people of all races. Others are more negative and reinforce hierarchies. And this invisible knapsack begs a question for all of us. And I'll give us just a literal moment to pause over it. What is one or more unearned disadvantage that you have faced in life? And what is one or more unearned advantage that you have faced in life? And how might this question feel different to people of color who encounter it? Now, at this moment, you still might be feeling, why can't we all really just, okay, I get it, I hear this, but can't we all just assimilate? Isn't that the idea of becoming American? I mean, my ancestors were German, but they don't still, I don't still claim being German. I'm American at this point. Can't we still move that way? Some of the aspects of history that we studied last week, some of the aspects of the knapsack and systemic racism, make this question more complicated for people of color. And I want to show this next clip because I think it's important for us to see. It is with the note, there is brief but intense profanity about two-thirds of the way through. I do not show this in any gratuitous manner to shock, but I think it is important that you hear the perspective that this stirs up, this conversation can bring to the fore. So this video clip is from a film. It's a little bit dated. It is called The Color of Fear. And you'll see the man who is responding. He is responding to a white participant in the group who has been asked what his ethnicity is. And the man has responded, well, my ethnicity is American. And I think there are a number of things that are important that this man who's responding says.
When you say that your ethnicity is American, there is no American ethnicity. You had to throw away your ethnicity to become American. That's what it means. That's what it means. You give up who you are to become American. And you can pretend that it's okay because you're white. When we give up who we are to become American, we know that we're dying from it. You're dying from it too, but you don't know it necessarily. Get ethnic, you know? You know, I'm not gonna trust you until you're as willing to be changed and affected by my experience and transformed by my experience as I am every day by yours.
That final phrase, I'm not going to trust you until you are as willing to be changed by my experience as I am every day by yours. And also the phrase that he said a little bit earlier, that he feels like the invitation to the conversation is come be like me, come dress like me, come connect with me and feel what I feel, and then we'll be okay. And it's a question to pause over. Is this what we invite people into? Not primarily as Americans, although we are Americans, but is this what we are inviting people into in our identity in the church? Is this what we offer them as a way forward to more unity? Is this what we show them when we show them our Jesus? A Jesus who looks an awful lot like a European. This Jesus is in many ways as accurate as this one as it comes to a representation. And although these images represent something kind of beautiful in how Jesus contextualizes himself to every culture, the truth is the Jesus that we worship looked a lot more like the Middle Eastern people that we're scared of. So what does it mean? What does it mean in the public sphere to be white or even as we claim our ethnicities a little bit more, to be European Americans? What does the gospel call us to in these conversations? Is it to be color blind? I would say no. It's to be color brave in the conversation, seeing and accepting difference out of love. And we look to Jesus as an example. And this next story, I could have just preached it, but I actually like the delivery from this black female preacher looking at Jesus as our guide.
We know this story of Jesus engaging in conversation with the Samaritan woman at the well.
and offering her something to drink as she comes to the well at high noon. Biblical scholars tell us that that was a circuitous route. He didn't need to go that way to get to where he was going. We also know that Samaria was considered a dangerous country in a dangerous territory for Jews, in that Samaritans were seen as enemies to Jewish people. They were seen as impure people, and I like to say they were the black people of their time. And so Jesus enters into that context anyway, and then he has the unmitigated gall to engage in conversation with the least of these, those that were considered the most impure and the most defiled, this Samaritan woman. What Jesus does when he does that is that he steps outside of the privileges of what it means to be a Jewish male. He doesn't live into that. And in so doing, he empties himself of those privileges. He affirms the humanity and the sacred dignity of this woman. And he as well goes against the very constructs, systems and structures, ecclesiastical systems and structures, political systems and structures that suggest that these people don't deserve the dignity of what it means to be sacred children of God. So these two things go together. Jesus recognizes the privileges of what it means to be a Jewish male, and he chooses to let that go and to identify with those who are the outsider and the outcast. And he does that not by saying, come to me and be the way I am, but going to them and affirming who they are. One has to name one's own privilege. One has to name the ways in which one sort of lives into that sin and live over and against it. And one has to, as one does that, a part of that is recognizing the way in which one indeed capitulates to certain systems and structures that are unjust. And we have to recognize systemic racism in this country, structural racism. And we have to, those who are usually gaining the privileges of that, they're the last ones to recognize. It's the privilege to be blind. It's the privilege to say, oh, there's nothing wrong with that. Just work hard and you too can do these things. That's a privilege. And so what has to happen is that people have to name their privilege, as Jesus did, step out of that privilege. And when you do that, you begin to recognize wholeheartedly the very systems and structures that allowed you to maintain that privilege.
So how do we move forward emptying ourselves? What aspects of what our privilege is are we actively laying down for the sake of others? Because we have been reconciled to God. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. As Shane has been teaching us, we have been given the Spirit of God. That Spirit within us lets us communicate with God and call him Abba, Father. We get to say what Jesus said. We are reconciled. And that Spirit also looks out horizontally. And all these people that I would naturally be divided from, unable to connect with, that same Spirit recognizes the Spirit of God in them and allows us to say, we are family. We are brothers and sisters. We are called to this. And yet, as we've shown, everything conspires to keep some of these systems hidden from us. So what do we do moving forward? First, I would encourage you to get more educated on these issues. As you leave this service, commit prayerfully to asking, saying, Spirit of God, would you open my eyes and my perspective to ways in which racism is present in my heart, in the world, in the interactions that I go about? This is a prayer he wants to answer. He is breaking down these walls of hostility. He wants to be a part of that healing in us. Also, as I said, get educated on these things. If Google is a great tool for this. If you Google things like resources for white people learning about black people, or resources for white fragility, you'll find great reading lists. I can recommend Jim Wallace's book, America's Original Sin. You can visit the new Lynching Museum that was just built in Alabama if you want to make a trip. On Netflix, the documentary 13th is very good, talking about the history of mass incarceration. Most of us, this education is really important because the stats show that most white people have almost entirely white social networks, not just online, but in person. If you know people of color, also engage in conversation with them, but don't always demand that they be the ones to educate you. Search out some of these things on your own. It is exhausting enough for people of color to experience these things and then always have to be the translator to white people. If they want to engage with you, wonderful. But educate yourself apart from that. I also would encourage you to commit to reading non-majority authors and theologians. I did this about a year ago. I realized I read mostly white people. And to expand what I was reading and taking in has been a really important part of beginning to shape and nuance my conversation. If you like novels, allow me to recommend the novel Homegoing by Yah Gyasi. It's excellent. Second, look for areas of overlap in your world. Is it at your school? Within your children's sports teams? Being present, going and joining people of color in conversation or just participating in an activity with them reveals that although there is difference, there's a lot of similarity. I think recently I was chaperoning at the zoo field trip with my son Magnus. Magnus, within his group, had a boy who had just come over from Japan. He had a boy who had come from Mexico and still needed a translator to be able to discuss the orangutans, and a young man from Ecuador. And as we all sat around the table at lunchtime, we ran around and said, "What are your favorite foods?" And they said, "Spaghetti, spaghetti, spaghetti, pizza." And Magnus observed that despite all of these different backgrounds, they all loved Italian food. Also, perhaps something to consider for a church that is white and where we are, what would it mean to purposefully develop a church partnership with a church of color to begin having these conversations or joint activities with them? 3, stop saying you're colorblind. This can be especially offensive to people of color who are experiencing systemic racism all the time. Our society is not colorblind. We should not be colorblind. Perhaps have the turn of phrase of being color brave. And as I shared last night, look for this as you interact with people. Look for this also in yourself. I shared last week, and I'll share it again, the story that I had of realizing within the last couple of years how I viewed young dads who were dropping off their kids at the Jordan YMCA. When I saw a young white dad doing it, I thought, in the middle of the day when I was there, I thought, that is a good dad. Look, he's here with his kids. He's taking care of them. He must have structured his world to be able to take care of his kids. When I saw a young black dad doing it, I thought, look at him. He doesn't even have a job. He's here in the middle of the day. And as I really stood back from that observation, I said, that is racist. That's a racist, and it affected how I viewed them, how I was interacting with them. As you see how color is shaping society and your own perspective, be willing to call it what it is for the influences that it has. And calling it out when you see it, it'll sometimes put you on the outs of conversation. You'll get labeled as a killjoy, or why are you bringing that up, or I didn't mean it that way. But the conversations have to shift as we're hearing comments about those people or who they are. Be a part of stopping them. 4, monitor your listening. What are the comments or the places that you get set on edge, where you think, I don't want to hear that anymore, you're just clueless? If you don't know the things that set you on edge, perhaps ask some people in your household or relatives who sit with you at family dinners. They might be able to point out what some of your hot button responses are. And I would encourage, what prompts shutdown for you? In those places, start giving yourself a pause. Invite the Holy Spirit into it. is probably a moment where listening would be helpful. 6, be an advocate. Last week, we looked at some of the issues of systemic racism, of policing and prison and educational systems. And these systems really do influence things. They influence how life is lived. If you think back to school integration, it really mattered who sat on your local school board and whether or not they wanted to keep Black children out or in schools. These local positions, they matter. They're shaping policy right now. And as God cares about justice, not just justice in the next life, but doing justice here, we have the great privilege of living in a participatory democracy where we can help be a part of the solution. Get educated and be a part of voting to help bring change. Finally, you can be a part of this solution in big ways and small. I asked my children, Ada and Magnus, I told them what I was speaking on last week, and I said, how have you experienced your interactions with people of different ethnicities? And how have you been a part of the solution in making these things better? Ada told me the story of a girl from India who she'd been eating lunch with, and she said, and you know, I realized halfway through the year that no one says her name correctly. They all say it the wrong way. They totally mispronounce it. And she said, and it really meant a lot to me. I practiced, and I learned how to say her name with the correct pronunciation. I learned how to say Anvi, and it really means something to her. And I said, Magnus, how have you experienced this? And my second grader, he said, oh, well, we just had the school talent show. And there was this second grader that got up, and not second grader, a kindergartner. And he was singing Sun, Sun, Mr. Golden Sun. But he was someone who had recently arrived from India. So as he was singing, he had a bit of a lilting accent. And Magnus heard the boy behind him start laughing. And he was laughing at this boy. And Magnus turned around and said, stop it. Stop laughing at him. And the kid said to him, turn around. It's none of your business. And Magnus turned around. And then the kid was laughing again. And Magnus said, and so I told him again, you need to stop. Stop making fun of him. And the kid stopped. And I thought, even as we think about how we are a part of the solution, that example of Magnus is great. I was just saying, be willing to call those things out as you see them. And as we close, again, why? Why does it matter? Are we doing this just to be progressive people or to be good Americans? No. No, we are doing this because we are the people of a gospel story. Because every comment about those people, every bad law, every unjust traffic stop, every whisper of racism is against the very heart of Jesus, who prayed this for us right before he went to the cross. My prayer is not for my disciples alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me. May they be brought to complete unity to let the world know that you sent me and have loved them even as you loved me. We have been given God's glory, and so has every single person that you get to interact with in a given day. C.S. Lewis wrote, "There are no mere mortals." If we actually understood this, that we have been given the glory of God and that everyone else has been too, how would that shape us? We are one. Oneness is the sacrament that we are given in baptism. That all of those old things, that nationalism, that division, those cultures that divided us, they are subsumed in a new identity. I mean, think about this. Think about what baptism continues to represent and represented then. That whole households, as they came to know Christ, that they were all baptized, the slave girls, the ones who were in charge, the Romans, the Jews, the men, the women, the children, all at once, all baptized. You are now one together in newness united. one in Christ. This is the beauty of our faith. This is the beauty of diversity. And it's where we are all headed. This is where we are going in the new heavens and the new earth. And frankly, liberal progressives or American idealists cannot even hold a candle to what we claim as the people of God. This glorious reality that Mexicans, Syrians, Norwegians, Cambodians, Americans, Nepalese, Ugandans, all of us all having those identities preserved and celebrated, that one day, this is the truest thing we are heading towards. In Revelation, John writes, "And after this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out in a loud voice, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.'" Last week, we closed with some prayers. You've seen these before.